Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Orange, New Jersey, and earned a BA in history from LaSalle and an MAE in education from Seton Hall. He's coached college basketball for 15-plus years, and since 1983, he's been known as the coach and has served as an analyst and play-by-play announcer for CBS Sports college basketball coverage. Some trademark quotes include, "With a kiss,
onions,
send it in, big fella, and a little
get the lingerie off the deck." Woo!
His name? Bill Raftery. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Bill Raftery. He's known as the coach, and we've listened to him for 40 years giving us college basketball. Bill, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Jack, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad, please?
Well, it was pretty modest, to be honest with you. You know, it was all about sports, basically. And, you know, making sure you got home in time for dinner and didn't have any problems during the day. Both parents were born in Ireland. You know, mom and dad were from the same county in Ireland, Roscommon. And didn't know one another there and met at an Irish club in New York, which is how things were in those days. You know, tough to get work and tough to meet people. And at any rate, they finally moved from New York to New Jersey. And that's where it all started. My sister Rita, my brother Fran, and myself. And we lived in East Orange for a few years and then went to Kearny, New Jersey, which is sort of a bastion of soccer. And if you didn't play soccer, you weren't considered an athlete. And my brother and I did play, and my brother ended up coaching maybe 10 state championship teams when he graduated from college. So many Irish and Scots, and now it's a varied group of nationalities, and they're still very good in soccer in that particular town. But, you know, we had a nice, easy living. I mean, we never wanted for anything. Nobody in the neighborhood had anything, so we all were in the same bag, basically. And again, it was all revolved around a bitty basketball at an early age and minor league baseball and soccer. And those were the three sports that we ended up playing, and I played in high school. And in college, I played baseball for two of the years and then started to stay with the basketball. But that's basically it. Nothing glamorous. You know, not a whole lot of vacations, no airplanes, no dining out. We didn't know any of that stuff and really didn't miss anything, we thought.
You played, as you said, basketball in high school, and you were later named Mr. High School Basketball in 1959. So you were tall cotton. Bill, in 63, you were drafted by the Knicks.
Right.
You never played...
I always say I was the 800th draft pick of the Knicks, which in those days, you know, you got an opportunity. They used to have a summer camp, and things are different now. And they would invite all the draftees, and I was lucky enough to be one of those that went from the summer camp to the fall camp. And the one Detroit area name that people remember is Donis Butcher. Donis was the third and or fourth guard, depending how you look at it. And the star guards were Tom Gola, who was all pro and all defensive player, and Richie Guerin. And those were the stars in those days. And I ended up getting cut, going home, and lucky enough got a phone call to see if I was interested in coaching a small college. And that's exactly what I did. There was no ABA as an alternate in those days. The nearest thing was the Eastern League. And you know, so I ended up going up to Fairleigh for the first 5 years out of school. And It was a great, you know, it was one of those deals. I wasn't learning from anybody. I did everything my high school coach or college coach did, pretty much, until you got some bearings and got your ears pinned back, and you realize you better learn a little bit more. So it was a real baptism of fire for me.
After 5 years at Farley Dickinson, you went to Seton Hall. You were there for 11 years. Talk about those 11 years at Seton Hall.
You know, just again, the beginning of whenever anybody gets a job, it's either somebody retired or the program wasn't going well. And Seton Hall had not played in the major arenas around the country, meaning they played in Madison Square Garden a while. And we ended up playing four or five games there against the best teams in the country. And we never played away again in terms of the teams that we brought in. In other words, we played Carolina or Duke or Maryland or somebody in the Garden. We were smart enough to know we couldn't beat them at home. We seldom beat them in the Garden, but at least we didn't have to go there. And that's how we sort of got the program to a level where it was palatable for the Big East. The ECAC was the right to go to the NCAA, and the NIT was, as you know, from the 50s and 60s, pretty important in the New York area and nationally, particularly in the 50s and the 60s. So in 79, the Big East was formed, and Seton Hall was a charter member. And I like to think that we were good enough that Dave Gavitt, who we had coached against when he was at Providence, respected the program and what was being done. And yet, we knew philosophically and financially we weren't up to speed of Syracuse, UConn, Georgetown, and teams of that, St. John's, teams of that nature. But at any rate, that's how we got involved in the league. And I was there the first 2 years of the league I was coaching, and saw what this could become and did become, mainly because of the visionary of Dave Gavitt. I mean, his analysis of what could be marketed and could be solidified in terms of an image was above the norm. He was an amazing human being. And the reason he felt that Eastern basketball could do well was he played a lot of the teams all over the country. And they had a beautiful facility in those days, the Civic Center. And they did very well against them. He made the Final Four in 72 and, of course, a number of other NCAAs, but it was his understanding of how good teams were in this particular area, and why not put it together, make it a unit, and start marketing it. And as you know, it was quite successful.
We're talking to Bill Raftery, who coached college basketball for 16 years and then got into broadcasting. When we come back, we're going to ask him, how did that come about? And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760. WJR. Welcome back to Anything's Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with Bill Raftery, who's been with ESPN and CBS Sports college basketball coverage for decades. Bill, how did you ever get into broadcasting?
Now, the crazy part about it, and I often tell kids to, you know, go out of the way to introduce themselves, get to know different people who visit their campus, whether it's alumni or others. And back when I was at LaSalle, we were going to be the game of the week on CBS in the NIT, and we were playing St. Louis. John Bennington was the coach. And Bob Wolf, who's a legendary broadcaster, came down to Philadelphia to spend 2 days watching practice and hanging around players and coaches. And our coach, Duty Moore, asked me to take him to dinner and spend some time with him. And the second day before Bob left, he said, you know, when you're finished playing or coaching, you should consider broadcasting. And at any rate, you know, I just thought of it, put it in the back of my head. And getting back to the Big East being formed, Dave Gavitt, the commissioner, was also the color analyst. And Dave, you know, he and I were friendly, and we were out one night, and I said, you know, Dave, someday when I'm finished coaching, I might like to do that if you ever give it up. And, of course, at that point, I thought I was going to be John Wooden, which certainly didn't turn out quite the same. And at any rate, 2 years later, we had started practice in 81, and it was about October 28th. And Dave Gavitt called, and he said, look, I'm not going to be the color analyst this year. If you want to do it, you have 2 days to let me know. So at any rate, the end of the month and first day of November, I called and said, okay, I'll do it. And so Dave was taking a chance on me, and we had three children, and the fourth about to come. Or the fourth had arrived, I guess, yeah. The fourth had arrived in August of that year. So I started, and I always tell kids, don't do anything for money. So I left Seton Hall with a modest salary and a camp and reasonable other perks kind of thing that college coaches are fortunate to get. And I left for, how did I do it? Nine games, $800, $7,200. And anyhow, that started it. And before the year was out, I did 23 ESPN games for $500. And then I did four NBC games for a considerable amount more. I forget the number. And I started with a bank, which I stayed with for almost 15 years. That, you know, you say, why banking? Well, in those days, they had the Jets. They had the Giants. They had the Meadowlands. They had the casinos. They had the Highway Authority, the Parkway Authority, all of those things. So we were more like salesmen. So by the end of that year, I really got close to what I made at Seton Hall, and we survived. However, from that sort of beginning, the next season I started with the New Jersey Nets, which I did for 23, 24 years, and I signed with CBS, who I'm lucky to say I'm still with, and I signed with ESPN, who until I switched to Fox 4 years ago, I was with. So I was blessed with people hanging with me, being loyal, and you know, just very fortunate the way things turned out. And as you know, more than the listeners, in some cases, it's one of those deals where there's always somebody better, bigger, more successful coming along. So I just put my head down and did whatever I could to be prepared and show the enjoyment that these kids gave me to the people listening.
Talk to us about a couple stories about the early days of ESPN, please.
Wow. well, everybody knew one another, and it certainly has grown in some cases to their dismay, where people are being let go now because of a lot of things, you know, the corporate mentality of a Disney, and, you know, maybe paying too much for rights. And, you know, obviously having so many people involved, they started paring down. But in the early days, it was much more intimate. You know, Scotty Connell and Chet Simmons were the two mainstays. They had started it. And, you know, you knew them and saw them every time you went up there. It was just like more mom and pop in a way. And this vision, and I can remember people asking me, what does ESPN mean? I mean, it sounds like something awful, doesn't it? You know, nobody had the idea nor the growth that eventually took place in the early days. But for the junkie, the college basketball junkie, it was a haven. I mean, you know, with all the bad weather throughout the country, I didn't realize as much. I was in Iowa for a game, and these two people who had their own farm were thanking me for ESPN because of the terrible winters that they were confronted with and really couldn't get out a lot of nights to see anything, that ESPN gave them a taste of the country. And I think what happened, Dick Vitale had a lot to do with this, where people started to, even the fringe people started to fall in love with basketball. You know, and Dick's exuberance, and it was a channel or an avenue for people to go and see whether it was their favorite team or teams that, you know, they just read or heard about. If they became, well, they started to embrace the game. But, you know, it was different. You know, you just everybody. I guess it's like anybody who's into coaching. Everybody at ESPN liked communications, and they didn't care what they were getting paid. And you know, it ended up where some of them did it very were well rewarded. But in it, they all started innocently because they loved what they were doing. And college basketball was the route or the avenue that they took to expand to the point they are now with, you know, the Monday Night Football, et cetera, et cetera.
Speaking of exuberance, Louis Carnesecca, St. John's, please.
Luigi, one of the all-time greats. You know, he's a treasure, Jack, to, you know, just the basketball, but, you know, to this area, this New York metropolitan area, you know, Louis is Louis. And he was part of the first name league that the Big East became. Louis, John, Rolly, Jimmy, you know, Calhoun at Boeheim. You know, that's the way it was. And Louis, I think, along with Syracuse, had the most to sacrifice because they were going to win 25 games a year. It didn't matter. Before the Big East was formed. And those two giants, both programs and coaches, were basically the foundation of the league. And you throw in Georgetown as well, and then later Calhoun, and then later Rolly a year later. But, you know, Louis is just a special guy, charming, loved his kids, just dedicated to basketball. His exuberance to this day, I believe he's, I hate to say it, early 90s. He's just the same witty, charismatic character, just an engaging human being with a lot of substance. He's just one of those special guys. And, you know, he just really loved being a coach at St. John's and represented not only the university but basketball extremely well, and you know, the Hall of Fame blessed him, but he had blessed basketball for 50 years.
Speaking of special and a treasure, the Wizard of Westwood, John Wooden, please.
Yeah, John, I got to know, I shouldn't say got to know, I first met John at Coach Wooden, I should say, out of respect, at a McDonald's game. You know, he was very involved in the McDonald's All-American game, and I sat next to him at a breakfast. And any time I was in at UCLA for anything and he was there, I made sure to go over. You know, I didn't know him as well as Louis and others, but having heard particularly Bill Walton talk about him with reverence and awe and respect, and to see what he accomplished, which will never be achieved again. I mean, his run, you know, with the amazing group of kids he had, whether it was a small team or a center or no center, was the modesty with which he did it, I think tells a story about, you know, this fine human being that happened to be a basketball coach. His, you know, the cards that he used, the simple approach that he had from everything, from what they tell you, whether how you put your shoes on or how you wore your socks or, you know, how you appeared or held yourself, the demands as an academician that you excel in the classroom as well as the basketball floor. And his contact with his former players was something special, too. I mean, they had a relationship you know, beyond the 4 years that he had them. This was just maybe, you know, one of the greats of the game, but maybe the foundation for a lot of people, that pyramid of success that many have read the book and many people have talked to him about it, who were the principles that he lived by and demanded of his teams. And you could see not only the talent that made them good, but the organizational skills of this man and his respect and adulation for his players as well.
We're talking to Bill Raftery. When we come back, we're going to ask him about another all-time greats, Dean Smith. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Bill Raftery, who in 2015 was inducted in the National Sportscaster and Sportswriter Association Hall of Fame. Dean Smith, Bill, please.
Well, Dean was an amazing human being and a good friend. I was honored to MC. They inaugurated a Dean Smith Award, and the first recipient was John Thompson. And I thought I knew everything about Dean until John started telling me the impact that he had on his life, whether it was late at night, about life, about dealing with young people. And the one thing that John said, he never told me what to do. He wanted to know what I thought was right. And he might lead you in a direction, but he would never tell you what to do. But Dean was with Frank McGuire when I was in high school, being recruited by Carolina. But quite frankly, I don't remember him because I only dealt with Frank, and I never visited the campus. But I met them at the triple header in the Garden. And anyhow, from those days on, we did play Carolina in the Garden. And Phil Ford, we played very well and lost. But Phil Ford, at the end of the game, ran the four corners, if you remember.
Yes.
One of his little pet innovations for the game to soak it away. But anyway, out of that game, and I mentioned to you earlier where we didn't return games, and to the day he passed away, Dean used to say, Billy, you never return that game from the Garden, you know, with that voice that he had. But Hadi Mahan and I went down and visited, in the 70s, and he gave us a two-day clinic. And that sort of sealed our relationship. And there's a group of particularly Carolina guys that played or coached, Roy Williams, Larry Brown, Doug Moe, to name a couple. And they would invite different people to a golf outing at Pinehurst. And we'd have 18 to 20 people. And, you know, the dean would occasionally be Larry Bird as a guest or Julius Erving. And I'm name dropping. But these were the guys that would come because of him. Jerry West is another that would come. And we would just have more fun getting to know him. And everybody had the same reaction. I didn't know Dean Smith, but I'm a fan of his now. As you got to know how much he loved his team, his program, his loyalty, not only to Carolina and the players, but to the game of basketball. He was just an exceptional human being. What he did in Carolina in terms of, the racial overtones of the time, having Charlie Scott as the first African-American to play in the ACC, and at his funeral service, which I was fortunate enough to be at, every speaker that would get up, including the pastor, and regale us with things that nobody knew, where he went out of his way to help people who were less fortunate, who were oppressed, get an opportunity. He was more than a basketball coach, and I think that's what you can say about the great ones like John Wooden and Dean.
Speaking of the great ones and special people, our own Tom Izzo, please.
Now you're hitting home. I think you saw this a couple of weeks ago when Coach Campy had us out there for the Coaches versus Cancer get-together. And Tom spoke for all the coaches in front of all the young kids and parents that were victimized by this dreaded disease, cancer. And again, the depth and not necessarily the personality, which is extraordinary, but the character of Tom is just exceptional. And, you know, not that it separates him from every coach, but just talking about him as a stature and a presence, caring about the community, the kids he coaches, the school itself, the community of the campus, he just sees things in a clear fashion. His feel for what to do and what's the right thing to do is above the norm. And besides that, he's a great basketball coach. He's he's legendary at this point. His humility is just the way it should be. you know, he doesn't want anybody to blow smoke. He doesn't need it. He's just, you know, going to go to work and grind it out. He's obviously been extremely successful, but handling it so well is what it makes him attractive to everybody.
We're talking to Bill Raftery, and his initials are WJR. Speaking of legendary, Raleigh Massimino, please.
The Rolando, still plugging away. Rolly's had a very difficult run with some health, and yet he competes, still coaches. He's 85 champion, and went to Vegas. And again, it's one of those things. Was it a mistake for him to go there? At that time, it was not his cup of tea, I don't think. But he had a great run. Well, then he goes to Cleveland State and has a good run there. Then he decides, I'm not going to retire. He's down in Florida, and a friend of his opens up the College of Northwood, which you have in Michigan as well, I believe.
Run by Keith Pretty.
Right? And then I think one in Dallas. And they opened up. It's since been sold and is now Kaiser University. And Rolly this past year had his 800th win, which is just an amazing number, as we all know. And that's what had his high school run of thousands. I don't know how many games he coached in high school before. But this is a true friend. We live near one another down in Florida. And the same enthusiasm he exhibited on the sideline. Now, he doesn't run up and down like he used to, nor does he bother the officials like he may have. But he is still buttoned down when it comes to practice. You would think it was a final game in the NCAA with the way the staff dresses for every game. And the program itself is as professionally done as any other university that you read about or see on TV all the time. And it's all because of him and his strength of character and his belief in doing the right thing with these kids. And in many cases, he doesn't get the best kids. He gets a bounce-back kid. I don't mean as a person, but as a player. He gets a kid who maybe failed at a university or didn't get the opportunity, and he gets a lot of those kids. And he's been in the finals in the NAIA 2 years ago, and he wins 20-plus games every year. And, truly a coach's coach. I think that's everybody who coaches against him has a great deal of respect for him, for what he's accomplished and what he stands for.
He may not get the best kids, Bill, but he sure gets the best assistant unpaid coaches, such as Chuck Daly, Billy Cunningham, yourself, Bobby Orr. Talk about that experience.
Well, we laughed because, you know, he had an opening game, the opening exhibition game against Villanova. And at his initial press conference, he said, we're going to play Villanova in the first game. And then somebody called Jay Wright and said, you're playing Villanova? Then the president of Villanova says, you're playing Northwood at the time. And Jay Wright said, I don't know anything about that. Like, Rolly just, and next thing you know, Villanova came down there and played. But the opening game, Bobby Orr, Bob Greasy, Billy Cunningham, Chuck Daly, and over the years, you know, Richie Guerin, John Havlicek, Sandy Koufax has been at games. And, it's just amazing the number of people not only does he know that, but that care about him. And, the kids, when they first started, so you'd have Chuck come over and run a practice. And Billy Cunningham would be over there for most of the home games. And it was just a lot of fun to go and see all these big names that he happened to be friendly with and that would migrate or on a beautiful day end up in the gym at night to watch his kids play. So he had a great reaction from a lot of people who have accomplished a great deal, which shows you the respect they have for him.
We're talking to Bill Raftery. Some of his trademark quotes include, with a kiss, onions, send it in, big fella, and a little lingerie on the deck. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Wasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the coach, Bill Raftery. You were very close with the late, great Chuck Daly. Bill, what made Chuck Daly so special?
I think all the guys that played for him, that, and I know you know quite a few of them, he just had an amazing ability to know what made them go. Psychologically, he was, I think, of all the coaches I met, way above that particular level. You know, he could read things. He knew what could spark guys and who to go to get things done, who could rally around him by, you know, some of the insights that he developed. But he was just, you know, I remember being out there in the heyday of the Pistons, and I didn't come home because I did a Turner game, and then on the weekend I did a CBS game, and then we went up to Milwaukee in the playoffs. And I remember not working one night, sitting behind the bench, and, you know, just chatting away over there and watching the game but not paying attention. And he's in front of me, and he turns around, and he said, "Did you see that?" And I said, "No, see? That's why you're not a good broadcaster." You know, what he did was he had a cross screen on a free throw, but he was always teaching. And I would go to practice with him during the day, you know, the day off, and just watch him. For example, we were in the car, and he said, "Do you think I talked a lot? Do you think there was dead time at practice?" And I said, "No, not really." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You keep talking, and you keep the guys busy when they're on the floor. Like, get the work done. You know, these guys don't want to hear you pontificate." So he always had little insights into why he did something. And he was just one of the truly great guys. And, you know, just sad to say, Terry Daly passed away, you know, this summer. And, you know, there's so many great little friendships that all of us had with Chuck that, you know, he got to know everybody down there in Florida and loved to go shopping. He would take all the ladies, my wife included. He knew where sales were. I can remember I needed a raincoat that was one that you could wear, you know, with good weather or, you know, snow or like just mild, but not too heavy, you know. And he said, you know, you go down here to Palm Beach and, you know, you go up the back steps of Neiman Marcus and you turn right and that's where the coat is. Go get that coat. I mean, he was just a fashion plate, as you know. But he was just a real guy and always taught, was always willing to spend time with, you know, young people, young coaches. But I will share this story about him. And we were, he was at Penn, and I was at Seton Hall, and we would scrimmage one another. And we would then go to the Final Four, and we'd have a ball. And he used to say to me, "We're one player away from being here," I mean, at the finals, you know. So anyway, he went then with the Sixers, and we played Rutgers in 76 when they won that undefeated team, only to lose to Michigan in the semis. And we're getting beaten badly, and he seated with my AD. And the second half, he just watched a few minutes, and he turned to Richie Regan. He was leaving. He said, "Tell Billy after the game he's two players away from the NCAA." So he had a great sense of humor, dry wit, and truly missed by everybody.
And his nickname was Daddy Rich.
Daddy Rich. Beautiful suits, just an amazing dresser, great taste, and he was a fashion plate, no question about it. But he was more than a pretty suit, too. There was a lot of substance to that guy.
Speaking of a lot of substance and a great friendship, for decades, you and Vern Lundquist. Tell us about Lundquist.
That's one of the truly sweethearts in the game. You know, I think all the good ones, actually, they love the kids if they get the opportunity to meet them. They love the game that they're doing, and they're in the moment always. They just want to enhance the product, you know, not diminish or take away. And as we know, many of the people that follow golf, the great calls he's had with Nicklaus and Tiger, you know, the football, the Rust Bowl, or, you know, the many situations, the run back on the extra point miss. And you know, there's so many legendary calls. But the reality is he's truly one of nature's great people. We're blessed to have him. I'm glad he's still working, too. He's going to do the PGA and the Masters, PGA coming up. But he's one of those individuals that he's charming. People love to be around him. Age has no bounds. I mean, I've seen young college guys, you know, come in. We were at a Michigan game, and we were in the hotel, and Michigan was staying overnight, and all the young guys came out into the lunch area, four or five of them, just to spend some time with him and talk about some of his legendary calls. But he won't be doing the football, but he'll be doing a little basketball and golf. So we're not going to lose him, but he's just got so much depth and just a fine human being, and loved all the years I worked with him.
One more, your partner Jim Nantz.
Wow. I'm getting old because Jim's first game, I think, was in 1986. We thought it was Miami, Arizona, and then we found out we did an Arkansas game before. And then a year or two later, his first studio game I did with him. So, I'm, you know, just to see his rise and his stature, you know, see him call the trademark events we have now and him to be the signature voice. You know, whether it's the Masters, the NCAA, or the Super Bowl, you know, just fun to see him. And it's sort of rejuvenated me to have he and Grant Hill, who's another just click. You know, he epitomizes what the NCAA thinks about a student athlete. And the three of us are fortunate to have this tremendous signature event. And to have him, you know, share the mic and keep us involved, you know, it's truly an art form. But we certainly are the beneficiary of his great talent, you know, his approach, his work habits, and keeping us in the mix on a nightly basis.
For the last 35 years plus, all of America has been the beneficiary of this Hall of Fame storyteller and Hall of Fame man, Bill Raftery. Thanks a million.
Heck, so great to be with you. Look forward to seeing you soon. Keep up all the great work.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.